So here's the thing about anger. It feels good. Like, if you're anything like me, I probably spend a little too much of my time sort of imagining how I will go about winning particular arguments that, in truth, those arguments are never going to happen. I just kind of live them through sometimes in my head and think, well, this is how I'd go about winning that argument or dealing with that particular argument. In a famous article in the New York Times, Tim Kreider, he said this about outrage. He said, outrage is like a lot of other things that feel good, but over time, they devour us from the inside. It's even more insidious than most vices because we don't even consciously acknowledge that it's a pleasure. And, as with all vices, vast and lucrative industries are ready to supply the necessary material. It sometimes seems as if most of the news consists of outrage porn, selected specifically to pander to our impulses, to judge, to punish, and to get us all riled up with righteous indignation. And yet, while I relate to that, and I can kind of see that happening through my news kind of feeds, through my social media feeds, I'm then engaging, as we are throughout this series, with James chapter 1, where James says, like, be slow to anger, because anger doesn't solve anything. Like, be slow to anger. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about being slow to anger. We've talked throughout this series so far about the various aspects of what it is that riles our anger, but how do we actually slow anger down? How do we do it? And I think the Bible guides us in this, but you know, you might like it, you might not like it. But I want to steal some ancient teaching to help guide us in this particular process. And then the teaching that I'm going to steal comes straight out of Jesus' most famous sermon, the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount is this long piece of teaching by Jesus, which is controversial. It is insightful. It's full of radical ideas. There's bits in it where people go, like, I don't even think you can do this. I think it's unfollowable. But it's unignorable. It's very difficult to read Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and not find yourself thinking, but how would I be able to make that work? And particularly, there's a section in it that I want to read to ask the question, like, how do we respond to anger? How do we respond to rage and perceptions of attacks upon ourselves? How do we put into play the slowing down of the anger cycle? The text that I want to read from is in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 5. And in chapter 5, verse 38 to 48, it reads like this. Let me read it for you just now. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Like, if you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you only greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, there's a text that has kind of, you'll see straight away what I mean, where this Sermon on the Mount kind of dumps all of this towards you, and you're kind of thinking, well, how do I go about doing that? So what I want to do with you today is just kind of slowly work our way through this text and just highlight some of the genius of Jesus as to how he guides us in how we respond to attacks upon ourselves and how we respond perhaps in the face of the things that would ordinarily make us rage. Jesus begins with a saying, you have heard that it was said. Now, you've heard Jesus say this sort of thing before, but this time he actually quotes a piece of the Bible. He quotes a piece from Leviticus chapter 24, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. Now, the premise of Leviticus 24 is about recompense. It's about making things even. So if you're involved in a fight, Leviticus basically is saying, and you do something that damages something of a person's, maybe it costs them an arm, maybe it costs them an eye, maybe it costs them a tooth, maybe in the midst of the fight, you know, you kill their dog, you know, or something like that. What happens is Leviticus says, okay, well, if this sort of thing happens, what's going to go on? And Leviticus decides that if you basically take someone's eye in a fight, then your eye should be taken from you. And if you take someone's tooth in a fight, then the tooth that they lost gets pulled out from your mouth as well. Pretty barbaric. Wow, like seriously, that's what the Bible actually teaches? Well, to kind of make sense of this, the first thing you've got to decide and realize is Leviticus is this Old Testament book that's set within a context and time that's quite different from ours. And what would happen in those sort of contexts is maybe two people would be fighting. And in the process of the fight, one of them loses an eye. Now, how would that get responded to? Well, that person might go home, they might recover, and then they would come back later, and they might kill the person who cost them an eye. Or they might destroy the family of the person that cost them a tooth. If they break their arm, they might burn their crop down. And Leviticus comes into this sort of context, and it says, hey, this is a really destructive cycle. Because when one thing that's bad happens, it starts to escalate again and again and again until everybody's getting hurt. I don't know if you can imagine that as a situation, that people would respond to one slight against themselves in a worse way. So what Leviticus does is it comes and says, well, what if we did something different? What if we actually responded in kind? So from what you do to damage somebody, that's what's done to you. And life kind of lived its way out like that amongst the people of Israel for quite a few years. But then Jesus comes along and he says, okay, you've heard that this is how things go, that you kind of do eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. But then Jesus seems to kind of point something out in this sort of process. That actually, and we're going to see him unpack this, that there's problems with this system too. It maybe worked for us for a little while, but if we keep sticking to this system of eye for eye and tooth for tooth, eventually everybody ends up blind and toothless. So this surely can't be the best way forward. Jesus' question is going to be, and the question I think we need to ask today when we live in a context of rage, is how do we break these cycles of rage? How do we break these cycles of violence? Because if we just live eye for an eye, we're constantly just perpetuating. He said something bad about me on social media, I'm going to say something bad about him. He said this, he said that, and we end up just perpetuating a system of oppression. Attack is responded to by attack. At the end of apartheid in South Africa, Desmond Tutu famously said, imagine if we had chosen the path of retribution and revenge. He said, our country would have been dust and ashes. And I wonder if we're maybe living in a context now where our rage means that we're constantly trying to take this path of eye for eye, of tooth for tooth, of retribution and revenge. So Jesus says, you've heard it said in verse 38 of chapter 5 of Matthew. You've heard it said eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, don't resist an evil person. And what's happened is when we read this text here, often we kind of read it in the way that Jesus is sort of saying, so just avoid the conflict, avoid the sort of attack that's being made against you. And that becomes problematic for us because, well, so we are supposed to just do nothing in the face of people who are perpetuating violence against us? So, okay, we get, Jesus, that we're not supposed to attack back, that you're wanting to give us something different, but is the option attack or avoid? And I think a lot of Christian teaching over the years has almost stopped here at this verse. Don't resist an evil person. And what we've done is we've narrated a language amongst Christians that sort of says, just put up with it, just live with it. There's nothing that you can do. And Christians have been perceived as these sort of people who are kind of weak with no way to do anything. It's just constantly just getting bullied and pushed around. But Jesus doesn't stop there. And what I want to suggest as we read through these texts just today is that Jesus doesn't give us a way of saying, well, here's how you attack. And he doesn't give us a way of saying, here's how you avoid. Rather, he unpacks a model for us. And he unpacks this model with three examples that I want us to look at. The first thing Jesus says is, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek. Now, I'm not sure about you, but you probably don't get slapped a lot in the course of your day-to-day life. And I hope that's the case. If that isn't the case, then you should probably get out of that situation that you're in. But slapping happened quite a lot in the world of Jesus because the world was highly tiered. It was considered that there were people who were elites, there's people who were kind of regular, and then there was the kind of slaves and servants of the world. And so what you actually find, particularly amongst the people of Jesus, the people of Israel at the time of Jesus, they had rules about slapping, which I know sounds kind of out there for us in the contemporary world, but they actually had sort of governance as to how you could go about slapping. Now, this then, you want to just pay a little attention to this. Jesus says, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek. Now, this is quite interesting for us to engage with here. And here's some of the rules that you need to know about to make sense of this passage. The first thing is, you can only slap someone, you can only hit someone, and the translations helped us here a little bit by pointing out that it's a slap that's going on, but you can only hit someone with your right hand. In the time of Jesus, basically, hands were given designations as to what they were for. And you divided your hands up into, you had a right hand, which was for eating and socializing type things. And then you had a left hand, which was for toilet-related duties. Let me just be really careful with my words here. And so you basically meant that you would touch people with your right hand, but never with your left hand. In fact, in the kind of time of Jesus, there are rules that tell us that if somebody was to kind of strike you with their left hand, like they would be very seriously censured about that. That was just out of order. So, first thing you have to know is you have to hit somebody with your right hand. Now, the text here tells us it's a slap on the right cheek. Now, because realistically, if you can only hit someone with the right hand and you go to slap them, the only way you can slap them is kind of with the back of your hand across their right cheek. Slaps this way were considered also really inappropriate. The idea of slapping someone with your open-faced hand, the area that you eat with, was really not considered okay. So, essentially, if you're going to strike someone, you've got two options. You can slap them with the back of your hand, or you can punch them in the face. Now, once again, there are rules in the society about this. There are social constructs and norms that tell us how to behave. If you slap someone, that person needs to be younger than you, needs to be inferior to you, or they need to be a slave. This is a world where obviously there's a lot of slapping going on because we need to have rules about this. If you punch somebody, that's the type of strike that goes with somebody with whom you're equals. Now, think about this. We're going to hold all those ideas together. Jesus says, if someone slaps you on a right cheek, well, you have enough data now in front of you to know what we're talking about here. If you've been slapped on the right cheek, it's by somebody who thinks they're better than you. It's by somebody who thinks they're superior to you. It's somebody who might even be calling you a slave or someone who has no power over them. So what do you do? If you strike them back, if you get into a fight with them, you've just validated the whole situation. They've slapped you and you fight back. You've told them that you accept their challenge and you accept that you're a slave, and now you're going to get in a wrestle, which will probably end up with you going to prison or even your death. Or you can just take it and be shamed in front of everyone. Look at this guy. This person hit him in the face, essentially treated him like a slave in public, like somebody with no social standing, somebody that's beneath him. And they just accepted it and kind of humbly sulked away in the background. Can you attack back and probably die? Or do you essentially avoid it and have nothing left to do? Or there's another way. Jesus says, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. So you've been slapped across the side of your right cheek. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to fight back? Are you going to run away? Jesus says, turn your left cheek towards them. Now, I don't advise you do this in the modern world because we don't have these rules about slapping. But, and you can experiment with this at home. Perhaps this is just a slightly weird kind of moment for you in your house just now as you watch this. But if you're only allowed to slap somebody with the back of your hand or a punch, how are you going to hit them on their left cheek? And you'll notice that you can't hit somebody on their left cheek with the back of your right hand. It kind of just feels all weird and looks all wrong, and you can't get any sort of purchase on the swing. The only way to hit someone on their left cheek with your right hand is with the inside of your hand, which you're not allowed to do, or as a punch. Think about what Jesus has just done. You're in a position where you're being abused by somebody. Somebody is raging against you, and you've got a choice. Accept that they have just treated you like an inferior and just get involved in the fight, which will go badly for you, or run away, or turn your left cheek, which is to say to the person, if you want to hurt me, if you want to rage against me, if you want to injure me, do it like an equal, not like an inferior. Now, this is an amazing social situation if this is happening in and around the time of Jesus, because people have watched you just be slapped in the street. Somebody said, you're inferior to me, and you get this slap, and you turn and you say, treat me like an equal. Now the person's got a problem. They can't slap you back because the hands are all the wrong way around, and if they do it with the inside of their hand or their left hand, they're in more trouble than you are. If they punch you on your left cheek, they've just admitted that they should never have slapped you in the first place. At which point, again, the kind of opinion of anybody nearby will be that you are so out of order for slapping this person that you actually admit is an equal. So what will actually happen is the person who is abusing you is forced to admit that they did wrong by you. They're forced to admit in the presence of everybody else that they can't continue this fight, that they were out of order. You've moved yourself from being a slave in their eyes to being an equal. Jesus shows us a third way of dealing with an oppressor. Not to attack back, not to run away and avoid it, but a way that moves you into a human space in front of this person. But Jesus isn't finished. He then says, well, what about if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt? Well, hand over your coat as well. Now again, think about this situation. You get taken to court. The Old Testament allows for this sort of situation, that if you've found yourself in a situation that you owe somebody some money, or you have got yourself into some trouble that you're out of finances and somebody wants to sue you, the Old Testament allows for a situation that you can sue the shirt off someone's back. There were all sorts of rules about this, of course. If you sued the shirt off your shirt, you're so poor that all you can give that person is your shirt. You're allowed to go to that person's house at nighttime and borrow your shirt back for the evening to stay warm before returning it the next day back to them. However, there's more to it than this. In ancient times, nakedness was considered shameful. If you were naked in the street, that was considered shameful, which it probably would be today as well. At least, I hope that's the case. However, what's unusually different about ancient times, you'll see this in Genesis, perhaps, in the story of Noah, is that when somebody is naked, who it's shameful for isn't the naked person, but the people who look on the nakedness. So if you notice in the story of Noah, when Noah finds himself naked in one situation and his sons see him, it's actually the sons that find shame upon themselves. It's the sons that are embarrassed. It's the sons that have done wrong. So imagine you're in court and you're so poor that all you've got to offer is the shirt off your back. And the person who's suing you is so cold and heartless and so unable to see you as human that their rage has got to the point that they'll even take your shirt. Jesus says, give them your cloak also, because now you're going to be standing naked in the middle of the court with nothing on. Except what will happen is this. As you give them your shirt and then you say, well, hey, have my coat as well. As you start taking your coat off, the person who's suing you will realize if he causes you to be naked in the court, the public opinion is going to be shameful towards him. The people around are going to call him the names. They're going to pick on him for being out of order for making this happen. So what's going to happen is the person who's suing you is going to run across that courtroom and beg you to keep your coat on. The person who a moment ago was asking for everything is now asking you to stay as you are. And you're saying, no, no, have it all. If that's how you want it, have everything from me. And now the person, because of the social constructs of their day, is going to be begging that things don't change. But Jesus isn't finished. He then says, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Again, what does that mean? This is where the phrase go the extra mile comes from. And when we use the phrase go the extra mile, often what we mean is, you know, just do a little bit more to help somebody out. So this is what would be expected. You do a little bit more. But that's not all there is to this particular story. Because again, this comes from the context of its time. Jesus lived in a world at the time that was being oppressed by Roman soldiers. And Roman soldiers had an allowance under Roman law that they could at any point stop a citizen from the country that they were in and require that citizen to carry their pack for them. So a Roman soldier could just see you by the side of the road and say, hey, listen, you need to carry my pack now. And they would give you their pack and you would have to carry it. But Roman law also had an allowance that said you're only allowed to ask a citizen to carry your pack for 1 mile. If you go longer than 1 mile, you, the soldier, could now be court-martialed for abusing the citizens. And the Romans understand that that's not going to help us be kind of well-liked by the country that we're in. So imagine what Jesus says. An oppressing soldier comes and says to you, you must carry my pack. You could be some sort of zealot and decide, I'm going to fight this out and try and get into a fight with that soldier, and you're going to die. You can run away, but the soldier is going to chase you, and you're going to die. So if you attack or if you avoid, you're stuck. You've got no options. Or, says Jesus, you can do a third way. Now imagine the scene. You pick up the pack for the soldier and you start to walk. And maybe you're talking to him. Maybe you're engaging him. Maybe you're humanizing yourself to the one that you would ordinarily rage at. And then the mile marker starts to approach, because all over the Roman world, they marked out their roads with mile markers so they knew how long a mile was all the time. And the soldier can see the mile marker coming. So the soldier begins to prepare to take the pack off you. The oppressing, strong-armed soldier, part of one of the world's largest ever war machines of its day. He starts preparing to take the pack from you, the oppressed and the unable to fight. But you say, no, let's go an extra mile. Let's go further. I'm enjoying this walk. We'll go further. And the guy who a mile ago was demanding something at the cost of your life, now he starts begging you. Because he knows if he takes you another mile and he is seen by this, he's now in serious trouble. He's going to be left and abandoned in a part of the world where he's not very popular. So the one a mile ago who was oppressing you and able to kill you is now begging you and beseeching you to hand over the pack. And you're saying, no, my kindness goes beyond this. Turn the other cheek. Give up your coat and go the extra mile. Is Jesus, he's doing something and encouraging us in something profound. He's leveling up our humanity at some level. You could avoid, you could attack, but there's a third way. A way that we could perhaps call what Dan White calls it affection. That we humanize ourselves. We bring ourselves into the presence of this person who would ordinarily treat us like dirt, treat us like poverty and scum, treat us like oppressed and unimportant. And by choosing this third way, we bring ourselves up into the midst of the rage and say, no, we're a human. Walter Wink, one of the scholars that works on this text quite in advanced ways, says this. He says, this third way teaches that evil can be opposed without being mirrored. Oppressors can be resisted without being emulated. And enemies can be neutralized without being destroyed. The third way, it forces us to acknowledge that we're all human. It forces us to acknowledge that we have shared being. And it asks us. It asks us to be creative in the face of a cycle of rage. It asks us to think, not simply attack or avoid, but what is the creative space that I can occupy that doesn't just offer more rage and violence back into the mix, but offers a different way. Tim Kreider, again in the New York Times article, says this, one reason we rush so quickly to the vulgar satisfactions of judgment and love to revel in our righteous outrage is that it spares us the impotent pain of empathy and the harder, messier work of understanding. But you see, Jesus calls us to the way of the cross. And the way of the cross is a way that does something different, creative, surprising, unforeseen. Nobody thought that's how you work with your enemies. We assume Jesus came to destroy his enemies. And Jesus did come to destroy his enemies. He came to destroy them by making them his friends, by drawing them into himself with his love. And the third way essentially calls us to the creative power of living out Jesus' way. And so he continues in verse 43, "You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Well, that's easy, Jesus said. Everybody does that. Even the worst person you can think of, which in his day was tax collectors. They weren't well liked in the time of Jesus. I don't know if you can imagine that. And in Jesus' day, you had these tax collectors, and they were considered to be the worst of the worst. And Jesus says, even tax collectors are nice to their friends. But you are called to something bigger than that. Because if God causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous, then God is treating everybody equally. Why? Because they're all humans. So Jesus redefines the contemporary notion of what it looks like not to just be with your neighbor, but to be with your enemies. Like, how do we redefine the contemporary wisdom of rage of today? How do we find a third way? How do we enact creative modes and methods of reaching through the options of either attack or be repressed and avoid? How do we find the affection? How do we see the people that we want to rage as people? How do we see them as people that are in need of a third way themselves? How do we rescue them from the cycles of violence? Like Twitter, Facebook, the news corporations, like, they don't need to define our rage, and they don't need to define our behavior. They might tell us that your only options are to switch off or fight back. And be honest, sometimes as Christians, we've just taken those as our options. Christians on social media aren't any better than anyone else most of the time. And it feels like our only options are rage alongside the rest of the world or do nothing. And it's easy to criticize, and it's easy to rage, and there's tons of data to fill your keyboard and your hundred and however many characters and your pictures and your Facebook. There's so much that you can do to fill that space. But it's not creative. It's not imaginative. The Bible would say it's not prophetic. It's not rooted in what God's called us to. And while we must always remember that as Christians, we're no more perfect than anybody else, there is an invitation for us to be different, to be creative, to be imaginative. Because everybody in the world is all the same. They're all humans. And the rain and the sun, as Jesus said, it falls on all of them. So Jesus' invitation is be perfect. Like, that's easy, Jesus. Thanks for that one. But of course, the word that Jesus uses for perfect here, it doesn't mean like what you might hear the word perfect. Rather, the word kind of speaks to being mature in your behavior. Like, a mature person knows that they need to love their enemies. A mature person knows, a person who's modeling Jesus, who's modeling God, knows that there's got to be a third creative way in this. A mature person knows the world isn't simply divided into attack or avoid. A mature person knows that you can be right and wrong at the same time. Your point may be right, but you're going about it in the wrong way. You might be being attacked, but raging back isn't the right thing to do. You might be being oppressed, but doing nothing isn't what Jesus asked you for. Rather, there's an invitation here in verse 48 to be perfect. Is Jesus sort of saying, hey, let's grow up. Let's avoid these immature, you know, cycles that perpetuate violence and rage. Let's not get caught in that. Shane Claiborne, he says this, if the people of God were to transform the world through fascination, these amazing teachings of Jesus had to work at the center of these peculiar people. And then we can look into the eyes of a centurion and see not a beast, but a child of God. And then we can walk with that child for a couple of miles. We can look into the eyes of a tax collector as they sue you in court and see their poverty and give them your coat. You can look into the eyes of the ones who are hardest for you to like and see the one that you love. For God loves good and bad people. Even God doesn't grasp for the knowledge of good and evil, but sends rain to water the fields of both the just and the unjust. And that's why loving your enemies is the only thing that Jesus says makes a person like God perfect. So here's my question for you about rage. Why don't you pray for your enemies? Why don't you forgive them? Why don't you wish peace upon them? Like, why don't you just try that? That's all I'm asking you today. Just try it. Before you tweet, before you stamp out a thought on Facebook, before you click share at that idea that riles you up, just stop for a moment and bless that person. Don't curse them. Just give it a go. Break the cycle of violence and try a third way. Grace and peace to you all.